Well, it's good to see you all this morning, and I'm glad to be here for our second message in this new series called The Hidden Hand of God. And this week, we are jumping into the book of Esther, starting in chapter 1. So last week, Dave kind of did our setup message to kind of set up where we're going with this, what we're looking at through this, and this week, we're going to actually jump in and look at the first chapter of the book of Esther. As Dave mentioned last week, this book is an interesting one in that the name of God is actually never mentioned directly in the book of Esther. And so it kind of is an interesting thing to think about, that you have this book in the Bible that's the story of God's story throughout the world, and yet his name is never directly mentioned. But as we talked about, that does not mean that his power and presence are not on display throughout this entire story, but just that it might take a little more seeking on our part to truly see it. And as I was thinking about the message last week and this sermon series that we're in, I started to think about many situations in my life where the power and presence of God seemed to be, well, shielded from me, where I asked questions like, where is God? What is he doing? Why can't I see or understand his plan? And I think that that's kind of a universal experience for many of us at different times in our life, that we may have had those thoughts or those feelings and felt like God just feels very far from me or from the situation, and it's hard to see his work clearly. And that's why we really wanted to do this series this summer, because the hope of this series is to help us to develop the ability to look beyond the obviously visible and to seek God and his plan even more intentionally. Because sometimes his power is very much on display and it's almost impossible to miss. And those are beautiful, wonderful moments. I'm sure many of us have had those moments in our life too. But there are also moments where it is not that way. And the question is, in those moments, are we willing to seek him more clearly, to press in, to believe the things we know to be true about God, and to look for his hidden hand? And we know that when we do that, God honors this act and that we won't undertake it in vain. In Jeremiah 29, verse 13, God says to his people, he says, if you look for me wholeheartedly, you will find me. And I believe in that promise. And so that's really the hope of this series and what we're hoping to do as we go through the book of Esther is to learn how to do that even more effectively in those times where he seems to be hidden. So today I want to talk about one particular way that God's hand can feel hidden in the story of Esther and that I think we can still experience today. And that is how living in an ungodly culture can cause God's hand to feel hidden from us. So Dave did a good job last week of kind of setting the stage for the historical context surrounding the book of Esther, but I want to just recap because I think that that will situate us in the story as we go into chapter 1 of Esther. So Israel, which was once just a people group originating from a single family who was enslaved in Egypt for 400 years, was eventually freed from their slavery and was given the Promised Land as a place to establish a nation dedicated to God. It's like condensing 1,000 years of history into two sentences, but that's kind of where you start here. And for a time, as we find the nation of Israel established now as a not just a people group, but as a nation with a land, for a series of time, they were ruled over by judges. But they really viewed God as their ultimate ruler. But as human nature is, they started to look around and compare themselves to the people around them. They started to notice that all of the kingdoms around them had what is necessary in a kingdom, which is a king. And they started to see the trappings of, you know, the power and the majesty and the beauty and the temples and the palaces and all of that. And they said, you know what? We want that. We want a king. So God granted them that request and established the first kings of Israel. And the king experiment started relatively okay, with Saul, David, and Solomon being the first three kings of Israel. But quickly, the future generations of kings of Israel began to walk away from God and began to cause some major issues within the country and the nation. Eventually, this is now condensing about 1,000 years of history into one sentence. Eventually, this caused the nation of Israel to split into two, Israel, the kingdom of Israel in the north, and the kingdom of Judah in the south. But even that didn't solve the problem. because these problems continued to escalate until not just the kings of these nations, but most of the people of these nations, the people that were meant to be dedicated to God, this nation that was meant to be God's, a representation of God's physical presence here on earth, they turned away from God and his path entirely. And that was when, after many generations of warnings and calls to turn back to God, both of these nations, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, were conquered, and the survivors of these nations were removed from their lands and sent into exile, into places like Babylon and Persia. So, several thousand years of history condensed down, but that's where we find this people group of Israel, where started in slavery, ended up with their own nation, had kind of the golden years, and now are in exile. And that is where we run into the book of Esther. And so I want to read Esther chapter 1 so that we can start to understand where the Jewish people were at in this particular moment of history. So Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 22 says this. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were all present. For a full 180 days, that's 6 months, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed gardens of the king's palace for all the people from least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. You can start to just imagine the scene here. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. But by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mahuman, Bizthith, Harbona, Bigtha, Abitha, Zether, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. I'm going to skip the seven names. If you're curious, you can read them. I've already read seven names. So the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan, one of the people I did not read, replied in the presence of the king and nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the people of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. We've now just blown a small situation into a national epidemic. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household using his native tongue. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, Sarah, interesting story. Definitely very visually enticing to think about what this story is saying. But what was the point of recapping the nation of Israel's history? Because if I'm not mistaken, they didn't show up anywhere in this first chapter of the book of Esther. So what in the world is the point of recapping the history of Israel and then starting the book of Esther with the complete lack of absence of the nation of Israel? And I would say to you, that is precisely the point. That is precisely the point, because understanding the context of where the nation of Israel has been gives us a glimpse into how they would have read this first chapter in the book of Esther. And their absence is one of the very first things that would have stood out so dramatically about this situation. Because if you think about it, for generations, the nation of Israel was viewed as the exclusive place where God's presence lived and moved, both among the gathered people of the nation of Israel and the land known as the nation of Israel that he had given them. And now, that land was gone. It had been conquered, and the people had been taken and scattered. Israel, in the form that had been known for so long, no longer existed as it once did. Its story has been completely taken over. This book, which exists in Israel's own scriptures, demonstrates that the nation of Israel is completely missing in action in their own history at this moment in time. And since the nation of Israel was so connected to being the place where the power and presence of God showed up, the obvious and very human question that would have been lingering in the back of every Jewish person's mind at this moment in time is, can God possibly even be here and still be at work? Because all of the things that were necessary for that in the past, or that they viewed as necessary for that, were gone. And they are not even a part of their history anymore. In addition to that, in addition to displaying the nation of Israel's absence from their own history, Esther chapter 1 would have also displayed a painful irony to the Jewish people, and that was that there's a kind of ironic comparison to the temple in Jerusalem happening here in the description of the palace of Susa. Because if the nation of Israel was the people and place of God's presence, the temple was the epicenter of all of that. The scriptures spend countless verses describing the beauty and majesty of the temple, which was meant to display the power and glory of God to the people. If you've ever read through like Deuteronomy or Leviticus or any of that and just been like, why are we going into how many stones were here, how many of these things were here, and you got really bored, what that's doing is it's describing the way that God set up this nation. And many of it is describing this place of worship, the temple, and every detail was so intricately connected to how the people were connected to God in this time. And it was beautiful. It was meant to be a display of God's majesty and glory to not only the nation of Israel, but to anyone who viewed it. But remember, the temple's gone now. The people are no longer in Jerusalem. Not to mention, it has been completely destroyed. So even if they were to go back, it's gone. And instead, Esther chapter 1 gives us this ironic comparison that in some ways feels familiar. We're describing the majesty. We're describing the glory of this place. I mean, if you think about it, as you read through the description of the gardens of the palace of Susa, it sounds pretty awesome, doesn't it? Like, I'd go visit if I could. Like, it sounds magnificent. But the irony that's here is that this is not a place dedicated to God. This is not a place that's meant to display the majesty or worship of God. It is a place dedicated to human power, human corruption, and the brokenness of this culture. and every excess is on full display. How would you feel as a Jewish person reading through this and being almost reminded of something that seems so similar on the surface and yet could not be further from the motivation and reason for existing? It would lead you probably to believe this is not a place where God could be or would be at work. This is as far as we could get from the intentions of the temple. And yet, this is where we're centered. And then finally, this chapter details the interactions between the king of Persia, Xerxes, one of the most powerful men to walk the planet at that moment, and his queen, Vashti. And really, there is nothing about this interaction that is reminiscent of the way that God had intended for men and women, let alone husband and wife, to be in relationship with each other. That was one of the things that God set up in the beginning was, what does it look like for people and the different genders to be in relationship with each other? What does it look like for harmony and partnership to be on full display there? What does a good and right relationship look like? But you don't see that on display here. You see Xerxes looking at Vashti as an object that was purely meant to showcase his wealth and good fortune due to her beauty. She is not a person to him. She is just one more trapping of this power and wealth to him. And he can do whatever he wants with her, including summoning her to display her beauty as kind of a ego boost for himself, right? To all these people. And then Vashti, on the other hand, ignores her husband, makes her own independent decisions, which you might go, well, yeah, kind of, I can understand why. But really, she's involved in a power play at the highest possible level. She is really trying to fight her husband for power at this high level. They both involve other people in this conflict, which only exacerbates the issue and now turns this marital and like individual relationship dispute into one of national proportion. And it ends with Xerxes revoking Vashti's title and effectively ending their marriage and banishing him from his presence. It's a pretty crazy end to the story. If you kind of track Esther chapter 1 all the way through, you're like, wow, I don't think anyone expected to be there at the end of chapter 1. But really, this interaction does not reflect the heart of what God created relationship or marriage to be and would have been just one more demonstration of how ungodly the culture that the Jewish people had found themselves in. So you have the Jewish people reading the book of Esther as a part of their history, their story, and yet it describes a scene where for all of the reasons we just talked about, the people of Israel would have felt that they were so far from what God intended, that they were in a completely ungodly culture, far from God's heart and intentions, and it would have been so easy in that moment for them to believe God is not here, God is not at work, and there is no hope. Now I, and I'm pretty sure anyone in this room, have not experienced a situation anywhere near the extremity of what the Jewish people were experiencing surrounding the book of Esther. Exile, the conquering of their nations and lands. But what I do think that we have all experienced are those thoughts. Landing in situations with people and places and things where we've had the thoughts of God is not here, God is not at work, and there is no hope. And yet we know the end of the story of Esther. Spoiler alert, right? We're headed towards an end where we know that none of those thoughts were actually true, that God was present, that God was still at work, and that there was still hope. Although the story gets darker, as we'll see in coming chapters before that hope appears, we know that that's not the end of the story. But how easy would it have been at the beginning of the story to think you knew the conclusion? To think you knew this is all it is, and there's no coming back from here. But the end of the story defies everything that this first chapter sets up and reminds us that even when situations feel astronomically far from God's heart and intentions, that we should and can still seek his power and presence. Because as Jeremiah reminded us back in chapter 29, if we seek it wholeheartedly, we will find it. And I love that verse from Jeremiah because Jeremiah is one of the prophets that before the exile even happened, before the conquering of the kingdom of Judah in particular even happened, he is predicting what will all happen. He's prophesying about it. And he is saying in that moment to the people, after describing for 29 chapters exactly what's going to happen to the nation of Judah and to the kingdom and all the people, he's reminding the people that even then, in those days, if the people were to seek God, they would still find him. And that's what's happening in the book of Esther. They are in the middle of Jeremiah's prophecy, and yet God is still at work. So that leads me to my ultimate question for us today. And that is, what places or situations have we given up on God being present in because of their ungodly appearance? Because of how far they seem to be from God's heart and intentions. And I know the word ungodly has been used in a very judgmental way in a lot of cases, and so maybe that feels weird. But when I say that, and when we describe that here in this passage, what we're talking about is a situation where it is far from God's heart and intentions. And that should bring more sadness than judgment. A recognition that this isn't what was intended. This wasn't what God hoped for. And yet, he can still be present. But it's easy to give up in those moments. And I know I have. And I know many of us probably have felt the temptation, if not the desire, to do that. And that's the question I want us to ponder here for a second, is where are those places where, like the nation of Israel, we might be staring at a situation, at a people, at a place, and going, yeah, God can't be here. I think about our land, our country, our state, our city. We just celebrated the 4th of July, and not only that, the 250th anniversary of the founding of America. And for many years, I've heard from friends and other people I've been in communication with all of these conversations about our country and lots of perspectives on what is really good about our country and also some things that are very broken about our country. And those conversations are good and should happen. But what I've also seen in those conversations was a hopelessness in many situations, or a sense of God is not here, so we have to fix the problem. And I was really thinking about it this week with these anniversaries happening and thinking, you know what? When you look back at the nation of Israel and the situation that they found themselves in, if God could be present in Persia, in the citadel of Susa, it doesn't really matter what we think might be wrong in our country or what we might be seeing. God can be present here and is present here and is doing things here. And if we seek that out and we look for that and we ask for him to reveal that, I believe that we'll see it and be able to partner with that. And I find a lot of hope in that. Even among the tough conversations, even among, you know, the things that are good to talk about, there is hope. And that's the thing I've been trying to carry into my conversations with people about our country, about our state, about cities we live in and the places we live in, is there is still hope. And if we seek God, we will find him. Because he's at work. Amen? Amen. I was really interesting this at Cedar Springs, we had a new director move in to town from Tennessee. And moving from Tennessee to Washington, as I've gathered in being in conversation with him, has been an interesting and a very culture-shocky moment for him. There have been many times where we've talked and he's been like, what is the state of Washington doing? And we're like, dude, we understand. Like, we are there with you. We get it. Many of these things we're just used to, but we understand. But one of the things that really struck me about what he said, because a lot of people were asking him, like, why in the world did you move here? Like, you were in Tennessee. Like, most people are moving the other direction. Like, why in the world did you move here? And he said something that really stuck out to me, and he said, God is here. Like, God is doing stuff here. And he is calling me to be a part of it. And so even though a lot of people back home in Tennessee didn't understand what he was doing, and even though a lot of people here were even like, what in the world are you thinking? Like, have you looked at the cost of living? Have you looked at, you know, all of these other things? He was like, God is here and he is doing something and he is calling me to be a part of it. And I thought, how beautiful of a description of the hidden hand of God, of like, so many people are like, I don't get what you're doing. And he's like, no, I see it. And I want to be a part of it. So where have we given up in our land on God being present? And where can we re-engage in those places? Where have we given up with specific groups of people where we say, this is not the heart of God, and so we've just washed our hands of it? A coworker the other day, I control the schedules out at Cedar Springs, and so a coworker the other day sent me a very normal message saying, hey, I need to have this day off of work. And I was like, yeah, no problem, that's what I do. And we ended up in a little bit of a more conversation about it. And she started to describe like why she wanted that day off of work. And she said, I want that day off of work because I want to go to the Pride Parade in Bellingham. That's happening that day. And I was intrigued and I said, tell me more about that. Like, it's kind of surprised me a little bit. And she said, I feel that the church has given up on that group of people, has given up on those situations. I've given up on God's presence being at work. And I feel like I need to be there because God is still there. God is still doing something there. And I was like, she's 21, she's in college. And I was just like, dude, you are wiser than most people that I know. And I was so impressed with it. I was like, yeah, done. You're off of work that day. Like, go do your thing. But I just thought, like, how beautiful was that? That, like, here is a person that is saying, I believe that we've given up, and I don't feel like that is the heart of God. I believe God is still at work here, and I want to be there to be a part of that. I think about relationships. This can come down to even just the more individual level. Places where we've given up on people because they seem to be so far from God's influence or heart. Both of my parents were essentially first-generation Christians. There were people in our families that maybe went to church or something, but both of my parents really were the first to have a relationship with God. And there were some that were more respectful of that, and there were some in our family that were less respectful of that. And I think about my Uncle Bob as one of those people. My Uncle Bob was my mom's oldest brother. Is my mom's oldest brother, and was a Marine, and kind of, you know, when my parents got married and my dad became a pastor and all this sort of stuff, he kind of took it as his own personal mission to try to make my dad as uncomfortable as possible anytime he was around him. Like, we're talking swearing, drinking, like, and it's not just like he was just living his life, like, he would go out of his way to try to, like, make my parents uncomfortable because he'd be like, well, these are things that they won't agree with. And so he just ramped it up to an 11. And it was an interesting dynamic for many, many years. This is when I was really little, so I just have heard the stories about this. But my parents really believed that there was still a relationship to be had there. There was still hope in that relationship. And so they continued to show up when appropriate and continued to be loving and compassionate and, you know, not get super offended, which they wouldn't have, but like continue to be interactive and be like, you're not scaring me off. Like, I'm not gonna let this be the definition of our relationship. And would you know it, several years down the road, my Uncle Bob started to change. And he started to open himself up more to a relationship with God. He met a woman who was heavily involved in her church, and as God sometimes does, use that woman to bring my Uncle Bob closer to him. And my Uncle Bob made a 180-degree change in his life. And it was like night and day. It was absolutely incredible. And the life that he now leads is not even recognizable to the person that I hear stories about from back in my childhood. And I just think, how easy would it have been to give up on him at the time where he seemed so far from God, so far from any influence or interest or anything in God. How easy would it have been for my parents to like wash their hands and be like, this is uncomfortable, this is not fun, I don't want to be around this, it's not even just like different, it's antagonistic, you know? And yet they continued to be in that relationship. And I believe that there were a lot of things that brought my Uncle Bob to Christ, but I believe that the seeds that my parents planted were part of that story. And I'm so glad that they didn't give up. I'm so glad that they continued to see the possibility and the hope in that. And now we get to live it out. My Uncle Bob was just up here for my brother's wedding in April, and he's gone through some rough things over the last couple of years. His wife, who drew him into the church in many ways, passed away from cancer a couple of years ago, and that was a really, really hard story. And yet, he's talking about how God is sustaining him and how his church is so present in his life and how he has hope and God has comforted him. And I'm like, dude, who is this person, right? Like, it is the epitome of everything that could have been hoped for. God was at work. It was hidden for a long time, but he was at work. So where have we given up? Where have we looked at a situation and said, this is too far? Too far from God, too far from his influence, too far from his heart. God can't be at work here, and so I'm just going to wash my hands of it. And then how can we change the script? How can we start to seek the hidden hand of God in those situations? And I would say the first thing, and we should be doing this already in trying to figure out those places, is prayer. Because not only can prayer help us identify where we may have given up, because again, sometimes we can be blind to our own hopelessness or our own sense of where we may have let hope go. But also, that is like the essential thing, because the whole point of finding these situations where we feel like we've given up is not to fix it ourselves. It's not about going in and saying, okay, I've given up on this situation because it looks like God's not there, so I'm going to step in and fix the whole thing. Like, that's not the goal here. And yeah, I know that that can be a very tempting thing to try to do. But it's really when we've started to identify those situations, we need to start a conversation with God to be like, where are you already at work? Because maybe it's different than what I thought. Maybe his plan doesn't look the way I thought. I am sure the nation of Israel had different ideas of what God's plan was going to look like for their nation. Even in this situation, I'm sure that they had different ideas of how God was going to free them from exile, if he even could at that time, right? But God was at work and doing something already. And I believe that in our situations too. And so the question is to start asking him, where are you at work? What are you doing? Because I believe you are already doing something, and I want to partner with that. I don't want to go off and try to do my own thing and fix it myself or try to make my own plan happen, because that's kind of not the point. I think having spiritual friends is really helpful in these situations, because when we get into situations where we feel hopeless or we feel like we've given up, it can be really hard to see those situations clearly ourselves. Often it has a lot of emotion attached to it. It's got a lot of baggage or history sometimes attached to it. And so it can be very difficult to try to navigate those situations by ourselves. And that's where having spiritual friends, where we can talk about our lives and talk about these things, and we can have people that have permission to not just say yes to everything that we think, but that can actually challenge us and say, I think you're missing something here. I think this is off here. I love you. I'm here with you. I get where you are. I just think that God is at work in a way that is different than where you might be at. Having that is such a valuable thing in our lives. And that comes from two things. One, developing those relationships. And two, giving time and permission for those things to be spoken into your life. If all we're having is a high buy on a Sunday morning, there's not a whole lot of like opportunity there, right? We got to create space for those things to be spoken to us and for us to speak those to other people too. goes both ways, so that we can see the hidden hand of God through someone else's eyes, because sometimes that's what it takes. And then, man, Scripture. There's nothing new under the sun. Scripture has thousands of years of history, including the story that we're reading right now, that describe situations and places and people that would have experienced God's hand being hidden in a way. And they give us a roadmap for what we can do in those situations, just like we're going to look and see through the rest of the book of Esther. So are we spending time in those stories? Are we reading them? Are we listening to them? Are we reflecting on them? Not just as interesting history or entertainment, but as instruction, as a way of understanding how God can interact with the world. So that's the challenge today. The nation of Israel found themselves in a very difficult situation in the first chapter of Esther, so much so that they were completely written out of it. And yet, God was still at work. And that's my question to all of us. Where have we been written out? Where do we feel like God is so far from these situations, and yet we can seek him? And we can do that together. So I want to pray and invite our worship team back up. And I want that to be our moment of reflection this morning. So God, thank you so much for this time. Thank you for all of the ways that you are at work. Thank you for all of the ways that you have not given up when human nature tells us it's very easy to give up. And I thank you for the hidden hand, your hidden hand, which is at work in our world in so many ways, in so many places. And I just pray that you will help us today as we reflect on the story of the nation of Israel and the beginnings of this story in the book of Esther, to also find those places where we may have said, this is too far. This is so different than what we would have ever thought your heart or intentions are, where we have given up on your hand being at work. And I pray that you will help us to see those places more clearly, and then instead of withdrawing, to press in, to ask you, God, I believe that you are here and I want to see you. Can you show me? Can you show me where you're at work, and can you show me how I can be a part of it? And God, as a community, I pray that we can do this together, that it's not just an individual thing, but it is a communal thing, where we as a church can look around at the places where you've given us influence, the people, the places, the situations, and say, where have we given up, but we don't want to give up because you are at work? Help us be a bold community that can do that and can be a light in your hands and feet in this world. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.